The Cubs threw a combined no-hitter yesterday, while Kyle Schwarber set a record for leadoff homers, and Matt Chapman signed a massive contract extension. We'll talk about all that and more on today's First Pitch. Yes, welcome on into First Pitch for Thursday, September 5th. I'm Lindsey Crosby. He's Christian Rau. And Christian, full slate of games yesterday. So lots of action across baseball and a ton to get to. But I think the first thing to talk about is Shota Imanaga took the mound for the Cubs in their 12-0 victory over the Pittsburgh Pirates. And with some help from some friends, they did this.
Two. Grounder to short. Dansby to first. Imanaga, Nate Pearson, Porter Hodge, a combined no-hitter.
Shota, two relievers, combined to no-hit the Pirates in that 12-0 victory. And I think, just kind of a rare thing to have. This is the first no-hitter at Wrigley Field since 1972. So wild that it just seems to never happen in Wrigley. But I think my question to you is this. Are combined no-hitters really a big deal?
I think they're still really cool. I think it's fair to say that they're not as great as if one pitcher does the entire no-hitter. I think that's fair to say. But I still think they're important. I think they're still an interesting thing to do. You took an entire professional baseball team, nine straight innings, and did not let them get a hit. I mean, that's impressive. Imanaga got out at seven innings. He only had 95 pitches. So to me, like, if I'm Craig Counsell, well, then again, you guys are pushing for the playoffs, so you guys have a bigger picture in mind, but and Imanaga's been your best pitcher all year, so I guess I understand why you don't push it. But at 95 pitches, I think he could have made the whole way. Maybe that's kind of a stretch, right? But Pearson comes in, he gets an inning. Porter Hodge finishes it off. And they both looked really good, by the way. If Pearson only had 10 pitches, Hodge only had nine. So if you take those 20 pitches, 19 pitches to Imanaga, that puts him around
115.
What's that put him at? Like 115, 114. I mean, that's doable. But regardless, they get the combined no-hitter done. And I think it's impressive. Now, some people don't think that combined no-hitter should count. I think it's a really cool stat, Lindsey.
Yeah, I think that Imanaga going seven makes this feel more like it actually matters. If Shota barely made it through five innings and then handed it over to the bullpen, and you had four relievers come out and all put up, you know, a zero on the board, I'd feel a little bit different about it, but seven innings, I think, is enough to feel like this is significant. I will say, though, to your point about Imanaga could have come back out for the eighth, he admitted after the game he didn't know he had a no-hitter going until he had come out of the game. He was not aware, because guys had gotten on. There was actually three defensive errors charged to Isak Paredes at third base. Part of me wonders if these were if this was an away game, would this still be a no-hitter, right? If this wasn't, you know, a home score. I'm not saying this is cooked. I'm just saying that it feels like...
Shout out to
like,
the official scorecard.
Yeah, it feels like the official score is going to defer to the home team in a close thing like this, especially a kind of game where you were like, oh, this is an... I don't want to make the first hit be, I don't want to ruin the no-hitter when I could give an error here. So it feels like this is a... This feels like this may not even stick around, right? Like, they may change this, the scoring change today, and take away the no-hitter. But I guess I feel like it's cool, right? It's not celebratory worthy, right? We're not building a statue of Imanaga or anything, but or of three guys, technically. It's cool, though. I mean, it's cool that they did it. It's not quite the same as a standard no-hitter, obviously. I think I'm in the middle. I don't agree it's worthless. Like, I don't think we should ignore it, but I don't think we really hold it up to the esteem of an actual no-hitter. If we had had this maybe second in the show, I don't think I would have complained that much. But, you know, if it was an actual no-hitter, there'd be no way we couldn't have led the show with that. I do find it interesting, though, that we had a couple guys try to get pretty close to a no-hitter yesterday. Mackenzie Gore, the Washington Nationals, had a perfect game, I think, into the sixth inning. Lost the perfect game, then lost the no-hitter, then lost the shutout all in the span of like three batters. But he did that. And then Zach Gallen, I believe, went seven scoreless for Arizona last night. Like, we had a couple different no-hitter watches going last night. But obviously, this is the only one that actually made it through to the end.
Imanaga's been having a really good season this year. And this last couple starts have been a really nice stretch. He started the season off like outstanding. People thought that he might be the NL Cy Young after his first, I believe, like, you know, five or six starts. And then he kind of fell off a little bit. He still made the All-Star game, but his last three starts, Lindsay, he's gone three quality starts in a row, all of them at least six innings pitched. Actually, two of them were seven innings pitched. And he's just really stepped up for this team in a spot where they really, really need it. Justin Steele going to the injured list. We're going to talk about a little bit of injuries later on here. And then them trying to push themselves into the playoffs. Imanaga has been a key piece in that.
Yeah, I mean, folks need to understand the Cubs are 4.5 games out of the wild card of the National League. It's something where Braves have the spot, Mets are half game back, Cubs are right behind them. And for being as bad as they were earlier in the season, they're 7-3 right now. And I think part of the reason they were bad was not getting great contributions. Dansby Swanson really struggled to open the year. I want to say as of like July 6th, he was batting 203. But since then, he's batting almost 300 over his last 50 games. Only six homers, but he scored 32 runs. He's driven in 31, still playing really good defense. And so for all of the concerns that you had in late June about Dansby Swanson's season, he's on track for another four WAR year. And then Pete Crow Armstrong, you know, one of the top prospects in all of baseball, really had a slow start. Obviously last offseason, last year when he came up, really slow start, didn't get a hit, really slow start this year. But Pete has turned it on, and going back to the end of July, since July 31st through now, Pete Crow Armstrong's batting 330, five homers, seven stolen bases in his last 30 games, and has made this, he's one of the fastest players in baseball and has made this a different team down the stretch. I think my question for you is this. Can the Cubs make a push and potentially get into the postseason?
It's going to be really difficult because not just because how they're playing, because they're playing great, but just the teams ahead of them. The Mets have just been unreal, and they're right on the doorstep as well. The Braves are starting to pick it up. I think the only shot, I think, for the Cubs, and maybe either the Mets or the Braves. So out of two of those three teams, I think the only shot of those making the postseason is if either San Diego or Arizona have a deep fall off, which is possible, but not likely. So I think the Cubs, as though as they're only, you know, four and a half games back, you know, 22, 23 games left in the season, that's still a pretty big stretch. So I'm still ruling them out, but I think that we're going to see some really interesting baseball from them this season. PCA has been really fun to watch. He's coming over from that Javi Baez trade. So, you're changing from 2016 and moving all those players. I know it was a rough time for Cubs fans, but you're finally starting to see some of that, you know, come back and translate on the field for you. You mentioned how great he's been since August. Before that, his month of July, he didn't even have he just had over a 600 OPS. Like, that's it. So really stepping up in September so far, he's got over a 1. OPS. He's really doing well with his game so far this month. I want to see how he can translate that for the rest of the season and see what kind of adjustments he makes in the offseason. Because if that's the case, Lindsay, I think we might be talking about a player that, you know, a perennial all-star if he continues on this pace moving forward to 2025 and beyond.
Right. Putting a boat in the Cubs conversation, remaining schedule or strength of schedule 497, 16th in baseball, so right smack dab in the middle, three against the Dodgers, three against the Phillies, three against the Yankees, but also three against the Rockies, three against the Angels or the Oakland A's, four against the Nationals, 3 against the Cincinnati Reds.
So you're we'll telling see what happens there. There's a chance.
There is technically a chance. I don't think I'm taking them over either Atlanta or New York, but there is technically a chance. Talking about the NL East, though, Kyle Schwarber hit a leadoff home run in yesterday's game. The day after, obviously, he launched 3 bombs. So 4 home runs, and I think the span of 5 at-bats. This was kind of a second leadoff homer in 2 games against the Blue Jays, but I think the big thing here, 13th leadoff homer of the season, tied the MLB record. Alfonso Soriano with the 2003 Yankees had 13 leadoff home runs. And you'll remember Soriano, one of the few members of that 40-40 club, which Shohei joined this year, Ronald Acuña Jr. joined last year. And so Schwarber said all of the right things last night. He's like, I've always said those things will be cooler when I'm done. Right now, I'm just trying to win baseball games. Winning the baseball game is cooler than that. And in fact, Philly did win 4-2 over the Toronto Blue Jays. They took it to Bowden Francis, scoring those runs early. 44 leadoff homers in his career, 9th all time. Do we think Kyle Schwarber has a chance to get the MLB record for leadoff home runs, assuming they continue to put him in that spot? The record is 81 from Ricky Henderson.
Ooh, that's a lot. 40. So what's that? 30. That's, I can't do math this morning. That's quite
37. I think he pretty much has to double what he's done so far. Yeah.
Yeah. Math is hard at 6 in the morning. I think that he can do it if he stays there, because he's been showing that he has the power, but time is clicking. Time is moving on him. I'm not sure if he's going to do it. So if I had to guess, I'd say that he misses out on that, but he probably finishes top 3. And I think that's a fair assessment. What he's done this series in Toronto, I don't know if he's ever going to want to come back to the States. I mean, this is his, he had 7 RBIs in just 2 games. He only played in 2 games of the series. He had 7 RBIs. That's his first RBI since the Atlanta series, not the series just a couple series ago, the one back
before that,
August 20th. Yeah. So, and he only had 1 RBI then. So he's really stepping up. It's a good time for them to get hot. It's a good time for him to get hot, because he was definitely slumping in the month of August. If he stays what we expect Kyle Schwarber to be, with that big 3 of Philadelphia, Kyle Schwarber obviously leading the way as the leadoff hitter. If he starts doing what we just saw in Toronto for the rest of the month, and then we see Philadelphia move into the postseason, we know what Philadelphia does in the postseason. If that happens, look out. I don't know if we even need to worry about what teams make it in the National League. Philadelphia is going to be on an absolute tear.
Yeah, I don't think he hits 81 for Ricky Henderson, but I will go on a limb and say he finishes probably 2nd in his career. George Springer is number 2 with 60. Alfonso Soriano has 54 in 3rd place. Craig Biggio, Hall of Famer from the Astros, at 53. Mookie Betts has 52, but it feels like Mookie was swapped for Shohei Ohtani in the leadoff spot. So I kind of wonder, will Mookie have many more chances to keep doing that?
I think second. I think he can definitely hit 2nd place. Looking at those numbers, I think that's a given.
He needs 16 more, so he needs, in essence, 1.5 good seasons like he did this year. You know, because Philly's going to bat him leadoff as long as he's in the lineup. That's just kind of, they've accepted he's going to bat 200, but he's going to hit a ton of home runs. He's going to walk a lot, and they're saying that's fine with that because he still gets on base.
It's a wild profile to put into leadoff hitter. I was always confused about it initially when they started doing it, because it's, you know, he's just not a guy that's not, he's not fast. He's not known for his speed, right. But he's figured it out, and it works for Philadelphia. And some other teams haven't translated or haven't changed that way as well. But I don't know if, you know, teams have that kind of profile like Schwarber, but it makes it really interesting. He's definitely changed the game in that aspect.
Yeah. The Braves in 2021, they used Jorge Soler as a leadoff hitter down the stretch. And I remember it being still pretty weird when they did that, right? You know, a big slugger, a home run guy who walks, doesn't have great speed, fits the Schwarber profile. But I feel like for some reason, the success they had down the stretch, I haven't actually gone back and done this research, but it feels like that was kind of one of the inflection points for teams to be a lot more willing to say, yeah, we'll put a big slugger who walks a lot at leadoff, even if he bats 200 or 225 or whatever, because he's going to get on base. So it felt like that was really the change that they made, that was the sea change, is You saw a team do it and have great success. I mean, Jorge Soler was MVP of the World Series that year when Atlanta won. So kind of feels like that was it. Talking about a guy who's never quite been an MVP, but has always represented well, especially on the defensive side. Matt Chapman, the third baseman, agreed to a contract extension, I believe at 12:20 a.m. Eastern last night with the San Francisco Giants. 6 years, $151 million. It will keep him there through the 2030 season. So it's through his age 37 year. And this is a really, really interesting deal because Chapman was coming into free agency as one of the big Boris guys and got that late start to the year, just like so many of the Boris guys did. Blake Snell, who also signed with the Giants, he recovered. Jordan Montgomery with the Arizona Diamondbacks did not recover. He's now in the bullpen for Arizona. But Chapman started off slow again, but since May 11th, his last 97 games, he's batting 265, 364, 493. 18 home runs. So he signs this deal. It wipes out the player options for 25 and 26 and the mutual option he had for 2027. There's no deferred money. There is a no trade clause as part of the deal. Is paying Matt Chapman $25 million in each of the next six seasons? Is this the big signing that San Francisco needed after losing out on Aaron Judge and a lot of the other premier free agents in the last few years, Carlos Correa, guys like that?
I think this is the contract that Matt Chapman was looking for this past offseason. He's finally getting it. So what I think when it comes to Giants, I think they were looking to sign a guy to go and have a pretty long-term contract. Now, I'm a little surprised that they chose Matt Chapman just because he's going to be 37 once the contract's over. Mm-hmm. The Giants, when's the last time the Giants have had a 30 home run guy? It's been a very long time. I know that's a narrative. He's at 22 this season. I don't think he's going to make the 30 this year, but it seems like if he continues down this pace, he might be the guy that can get that 30 home runs for San Francisco. This offseason is going to be different now for San Francisco, I think. Now, you did trade Jorge Soler, so some of this money of the Soler trade is helping the Chapman extension, but there's going to be some interesting free agents this year, and you thought that San Francisco might be in the mix for some of them. Do you think that changes now? Do you think that now that they've signed this long-term deal to Chapman, that they stop, they don't go, or do you think that means that they're going to be now in an all-in kind of status because they have a 31-year-old as their platform guy?
I think I'm not maybe as worried about signing Chapman long-term as I would be somebody else because his defense has been some of the best in baseball at third base. And so as he naturally ages and regresses a bit, I feel like that defense, barring a complete collapse of his athleticism, it feels like he should be at least be able to be above average defensively. I do agree that you are significantly stuck in, you need his bat to perform, right? Like to your point of the 30 home run thing, he's passed 30 home runs once in his career. He had 36 in 2019, was a sixth place finisher in MVP voting, was an all-star. His only all-star selection actually was 2019, age 26 with Oakland. And even then he batted only 249. He's a career 241 hitter. He averages 29 homers per 162 games. You know, strikes out 180 times on average per season. It really, I don't know, it feels like you're buying at the absolute highest possible value, right? Yeah. I don't know if, like, I feel comfortable enough that the defense will be enough for you through the age of 37. I just worry that the bat is not going to maintain. I mean, he had two consecutive years, his year in Oakland at age 28, and his year in Toronto at age 29, he batted 210 and 229 back-to-back years. The year before that, he was only 232 in Oakland, although it was 2020 in a shortened season, so we try to ignore that that even existed. It feels like this is the deal you didn't have to make right now. Like you didn't have to go as far as you did for as much money as you did to get the caliber of player you got, because I feel like this is an overpay for what Matt Chapman historically has been. You're buying the potential of Matt Chapman. He's only once had a batting average over 250 in his career, and that was 2018, where he, you know, 278 on base. I'm sorry, 278 batting average, 24 homers, still struck out 140 something times. Like, he's only one time bat over 250. And it just feels like if you have any slip in bat speed, you know, or offensive production, all of a sudden this is kind of an albatross contract. But at the same time, the Giants have missed on so many big name free agents. They tried to sign Correa. They tried to sign Aaron Judge. They got Snell. He's probably going to opt out. And I do think you free up some money. You mentioned Jorge Soler being traded to Atlanta. You free up the cash next year for Blake Snell, I believe, was supposed to be $30 million. So you free up a lot of money if Snell opts out, which it feels like he will. He's been great down the stretch. You could afford to do this, but this feels more like an ownership decision than a front office decision, if that makes sense.
I think it shows that they're not optimistic about their chances in the offseason after what happened the last couple seasons. I just want to see how aggressive they are this winter after making this Chapman decision, especially if Snell moves on and opts out of his contract. What will be their next step? Because the Giants are itching to fight with the Dodgers. And, you know, the NL West right now is an interesting division, and we're not really talking about the Giants in it. They're the fourth best team in their division. But they easily could be a team that could make that next step and jump into the wild card race with like one or two more additions. And they don't have to be Juan Soto.
Yeah. And remember, they're 2 years away. I think it's two seasons away from winning 100 games, although it's now increasingly looking like that was the flukiest of fluke years because of what they've done last 2 years since then. But it's an interesting position. I would argue, and we'll probably have to do this on a different show because we're running short on time for this segment, but I'd argue the NL West and the AL East are probably the two most competitive divisions top to bottom, as far as you really have nine competitive teams that could be competitive amongst the 10 teams in those divisions, everybody but Colorado. So just interesting to kind of see, and to your point, I want to see what they do this offseason. I'm curious about what else happens there. All right, hopping into quick pitch real quick. A lot of interesting things to get to. First, Baseball America updated their top 100 list. We have a new number one prospect, Tampa Bay Rays third baseman Junior Caminero. Some of the best power in all of the minor leagues. His average exit velocities, his 90th percentile exit velocities, are right up there in the tier with Aaron Judge, Shohei Ohtani, Giancarlo Stanton, Ronald Acuna Jr., the sluggiest of sluggers in baseball. Are you surprised that Caminero got the nod, or is this something that, like, we knew once everybody caught up to how good he was, this would have inevitably be the case?
Oh, come on. We knew. Look at our Discord profile picture. And by the way, if you haven't joined our Discord, the link's below. Junior Caminero has been our profile picture for the last month now. Right? We knew. Come on now. We knew it happened. But I think that it's an interesting decision to make Caminero the number one prospect because he's not going to be there very long. You know, he's already up in the majors. He's going to graduate quick, but I think he is deserving of getting the nod before he does graduate out. It's going to be interesting to see in the offseason who the next number one is, because when you look at who the next number one can be, I don't think there's a clear number one. I don't think there's a clear prospect that can be, okay, that's the next guy across baseball. So that will be the next interesting decision. But looking at Caminero, what he's done so far since he's got called back up to Tampa has been really interesting. And, hey, they traded Isaac Paredes away to find some room for him on the roster. And
they traded an all-star third baseman away. Yeah.
So they know that they got something out of this guy. And not only am I excited to see, you know, what he can do for the rest of the season, I'm interested to see if he's going to sign a long-term deal. If I'm Tampa Bay, I'm trying my hardest to have him sign a long-term deal this offseason.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. He's played 28 games in the majors. So like you said, he's on track to be right there around losing rookie eligibility this year, depending on how much he plays down the stretch. We'll see what happens with that. A full season next year at third base, he could potentially be in line for a rookie of the year campaign. So we'll see how they handle that. And for we will do more talk about prospects. Let's find the next day we have with a small a small slate of games. We'll find a time to talk and chat and have that next number one overall prospect conversation. So hold me to that, everybody. Couple injury issues yesterday. One, some hit by pitches. Bryce Harper hit by a pitch on his right elbow. Reminder, he's been dealing with the left elbow issues. His throwing elbow, the one he had Tommy John on, I believe. And then left the game after being hit by a pitch with that right elbow. Said he thinks he'll be fine. Said that after the game. Brandon Marsh also got hit by a pitch. Did not leave the game. Stayed in the game last night, but also got hit. I think he took his in the ribs. It all kind of goes back to the Whit Merrifield hit by pitch in the head in the series opener versus Colorado. He missed last night's game. He sat out. He passed concussion testing, passes CT scan, but he said when they had the rules committee meeting on Wednesday morning, he said in the clubhouse before last night's Braves game that he expects there to be a rule in place by next season that would provide some sort of accountability for pitchers who repeatedly and or egregiously hit players, you know, above the head, above the shoulders, things like that. Which is a better idea? I've seen both ideas floated around. We had a nice debate about it yesterday on the Braves pod, and I'll link that down below. Which is a better idea? An automatic ejection for a hit by pitch above the shoulders, or if a pitch comes in above and hits a guy above the shoulders, you get two bases instead of one?
Oh, never heard that second one. That's an interesting one. I'm still going to lean with the first one. I think that if you hit in the neck or shoulder or head area, this should be an automatic ejection because that means you're nowhere near the strike zone. Now, I think there's some discretion there. Like, obviously, the batter can't bend in.
The dude's ducking into it, yeah.
Right, like, that can't happen. But I think the easiest way that you determine that is take a nod from college football. Anytime there's a targeting call, they review it, right? There's replay in baseball. So I think that you can review any of those hit by pitches to determine if the pitcher needs to be ejected. And the way that the replay rooms are in New York with baseball, it won't take that long for it to happen. So I'm going to say that one. I think that if you are hitting a player in the head or neck area, you should be automatically ejected. I think that's justified.
Yeah, that kind of makes sense there. Okay, so two significant IL placements yesterday. Justin Steele of the Chicago Cubs goes on the IL with left elbow flexor tendonitis. Corey Seager, the Texas Rangers, goes on the IL with hip inflammation. Which of these is more concerning for 2025? Or are they at all?
For 2025, I'm not sure how deep Seager is going to be because, one, they're probably over, so I think he just gets shut down for the rest of the year. But I think Steele is the biggest issue for not only this year, but 2025. Because when you're talking about elbow inflammation, that just throws up red flags to me. Hopefully
flexor,
that doesn't mean...
Really?
Yeah. Ooh, hopefully that means that we're not talking like Tommy John surgery or anything like that. Hopefully it's just something that just needs a little bit of rest and gets over. But I'm not optimistic, Lindsay. When you hear when you hear those type of injuries, more times than not, we're talking surgeries or some sorts like that. So definitely Justin Steele have a potential impact for the next season.
And he did say he had an MRI Tuesday morning, was happy with the early results. The quote was, there's no severe damage or anything like that, just some inflammation that was kind of expected to be seen. And he thinks he will return this season. So you have to hope that that is the case, that he does make it back. But either way, you never love to hear elbow or flexor inflammation, the flexor tendon right there near the elbow. It feels like there's a nice correlation between that and guys eventually needing Tommy John. So you hope it's not that. Speaking of injuries, though, Yoshinobu Yamamoto is expected to return on Tuesday. He's expected to not go incredibly deep. He hasn't really gone over 40 or 50 pitches in his rehab starts, but he will return. He has three starts potentially before the postseason, provided that this doesn't go poorly. As of right now, is he the game one starter for the Dodgers in the playoffs?
I don't know if I want to say game one. I'll say game two. I think Flaherty can take game one if Glasnow's still not 100%. But Yamamoto, him coming back, is absolutely crucial because Bobby Miller didn't have a good outing yesterday. He got absolutely beat up against the Diamondbacks. We've seen Warblowski have a bad outing. Kershaw's still out. So having Yamamoto back, even if he is the game two guy, is absolutely crucial. So hopefully it works out. Three starts, that should be enough to get him built back up to at least go 80, 85 pitches. And that should be enough in the postseason because you rely on your bullpen usually a little bit more in those games.
Yeah. So Dodgers dropped that game to the Angels 10-1. And to your point on Bobby Miller, 5 innings, 5 hits, 7 runs, 3 walks, 8 strikeouts, gave up 3 homers. Mickey Moniak took him deep in the first, Nico Cavadas in the second, Taylor Ward in the fifth. So a little bit scary there for them. Last little note here. We're kind of running late on time, but speaking of teams going wild and folks getting blasted, the Cincinnati Reds had just an absolutely massive game here against the Houston Astros. They won 12-5, and the loss went on to Spencer Arrighetti. 2/3 of an inning, 6 hits, 9 runs, 3 walks to no strikeouts. Eloy De La Cruz in the first inning came up to bat twice. He had a single, he had a double, he stole a base, he scored 2 runs, he drove in 2. Arrighetti's coming off of 2 consecutive quality starts with 0 runs allowed. 6 innings against Baltimore, 7 2/3 against Philly, both on the road with a combined 5 hits allowed, 5 walks, 17 strikeouts. Is this outing yesterday a reason to be concerned, or is this the, yeah, everybody gets blown up once or twice and this one just happened to be worse than usual?
Knees weak, arms are heavy. Uh-oh, Arrighetti, right? That's exactly where we need to be with this one. No, I don't think you need to be too concerned. I'm glad I got you with that one. But this is his 103 pitches is the most he's thrown all year in that last outing against Philadelphia. I don't know if you really need to look at that, but that's, you know, he went almost the distance. And then before he gave up a hit in that one against the Phillies. And then he comes out and just, you know, craps the bed. Eloy De La Cruz went absolutely off in this one. They wound up winning the game 12-5. They only had 1 home run. It was the second pitch of the game against Arrighetti, Jonathan India. And then the rest was just a hit parade by the entire team. I'm not too concerned about Arrighetti. I think he's going to be a great pitcher for his entire career. I'm actually really excited about the young pitching core that Houston has with him and Hunter Brown. Hunter Brown had a horrible way to start his year, and he's starting to figure out as well. So these are just those little adjustments that these young pitchers need to figure out, and that's where I'm going to put this one at. But it's not a great time because Houston's, you know, still trying to hold off the rest of the AL West and get themselves a good playoff spot.
Yeah, I will say you have to love the efficiency. He faced 11 batters. He only threw 38 pitches. So you have to love the efficiency. But he did also have his last start against Philly was the 28th. So he had plenty of time off. It's just one of those. I'm inclined to think that Arrighetti's just a dude that when he has a bad game, he has a bad game. Detroit on June 15th got him for 7 runs on 5 hits and 1 1/3 innings, right? I think it's just when he has a bad game, it's a really bad game. But long term, I don't think I'm concerned about this. So I'm kind of with you there. This has been First Pitch for Thursday, September 5th. If you're listening on audio, do us a favor. Leave us a 5-star review. It really does mean a ton. Share the show with your friends. And if you're on YouTube, leave us a comment down below. If you have any questions, we'll get to those on the next episode of the show. And subscribe to the channel. Hit the notification bell so you know when we go live. Until next time, this has been First Pitch.